Hi, I'm Andy Cheng. I'm currently heading up Marketing Technology Engagement Solutions for Electrolux Group. Join me on the Forward podcast with Smart OSC. I'll be talking about marketing technology and leadership.
It was a goddamn wake-up call, right? Because when everything was right, you know, it seems to be in good harmony, and then you think that it's because of you're very good. But it's not, actually. You're just living on a credit. And then when the reality strikes, oh, sorry, but what I've known before has already, like, is no longer the case. So what did I do wrong? When did I start living upon these credits? I mean, and I have to go back and reprogram that mind myself. And you know, that's like in that loop. You know? The benefit of AI will outweigh the disadvantages of AI.
Hello, everyone. You are very welcome to the Forward podcast with Smart OSC. I am your host, Aziza O'Byrne. But more importantly, we have a really, really, really exciting episode for you today because we are coming to you live from Bangkok with Model Creative and our very special guest, Andy Cheng. Andy Cheng, thank you so much for joining us today. I'm wondering if you wouldn't mind, tell us a little bit about yourself for our listeners.
Thank you, Aziza. So first and foremost, really, really excited to be here. Finally, to see both all of you in person. So I'm Andy Cheng, currently working with Electrolux. Been with this place for 4.5 years, heading up engagement solutions, marketing technology team, leading up the global organization. So I'm responsible for 4 different regions within Electrolux.
Brilliant, brilliant. So one thing we've been asking our guests this season is what drives them forward. Mm-hmm. So maybe that will tell us a little bit more about you. What drives you forward in your life and in your career?
I think, you know, very, very good question, right? I mean, always, Aziza, you always, you know, hit me with all these deep thoughts.
We've spoken from the get-go. Yeah, we've spoken before, and we had a conversation before about how we love psychology and how we love deep thinking and deep conversations. So I think we're going to go right into that today. So there we go.
Absolutely. So what drives me forward? I think ultimately the pursuit of knowledge, and you know, like, it doesn't have to be fixed, right? You always keep on pursuing that higher form of knowledge, and you go further and further at work and outside of work. Ooh. Right? And that's, you know, I think that we all of us have our aims, purpose, and that's, you know, of course, they're, you know, each and every one of us are different. And for, to me, it would be a knowledge that I pursued constantly, right? Yeah.
So you'd say you're a very curious person.
Yes, no, indeed. I mean, like, you know, what do we know, right? I mean, you know, we have our understanding of the world, but, you know, at some point when you learn new things, you have to reorient your thoughts. Then it's all different once again, right? I mean, that's really excites me, that I feel the sense of a growing person, you know, in this process, right?
You've been the type of person who learns a lot by doing. And looking at your career journey so far, you have come such a long way from your early days as a network engineer to where you are now in Electrolux. Would you mind telling our listeners a little bit about that journey to where you are now, that learning by doing, and what got you to where you are today?
Absolutely. It's funny because sometimes what life has to give you, you know, is better than what you think you can get for yourself. And that's to summarize my 2 decades worth of experience. You know, everybody has a plan until they got hit in the face. And I always had a plan. Yeah. And I always get hit in the face as well. You know, that's a sense of humor that the life has to give you, right? So I started off as a network engineer, as you rightly mentioned. But, you know, I think the most important part is what I have to give you a bit of a story before that happens, right? So I started off at the university, picked the subject computer science. I was literally a useless gamer. I mean, useful gamer, but you know, if you depending on how you're looking at, right? But as a gamer, you're useful. But you know, if you're going to look at it from the lens of the live, you are useless, right? So I was that. But then, you know, one thing about gaming is that you have to build your own computers. And that really motivates you. Like, oh, I'm going to build the strongest computer ever. You compete against your friends. Like, I have a stronger computer than yours. So that was the start of my computer appetite when I was pretty young at that time. So I picked computer science. I thought that it was about building this sort of hardware, like, you know, like dealing literally with the electronic pieces and stuff. But then it turns out that, you know, after enrolling it and then started studying, it turns out that it's not about computer hardwares. It's to do with software. So that was entirely upside down. I mean, like, then I have to, you know, like I even went through the process of, you know, deregistering myself and then re-enrolling it in a different way, because, you know, if I really going to study what I wanted to study, that is under the computer engineering.
Yeah.
Separate field, right?
And it's a big time commitment.
Under the engineering faculty. Yeah. It's the whole faculty. I made a mistake over the whole faculty, by the way. Turns out I'm in the information technology faculty instead. So, yeah, okay, damn. I live with my aunt, so you know, she sponsored me and everything. So she's going to definitely kill me, right? But I'm going to have to deregister myself and do it over there, because like you literally have to lose what you paid for the whole semester. So yeah, I went ahead with it, and you know, like no worries. You know what? Like, study's never been my thing anyway. So then I started studying, like in my second year, I started to realize, didn't even know what software it was, and you know, like no interest in that. And then I was like, okay, so software is essentially a mind of a computer, where hardware is the body of a human, right? Like a body of a computer. And you can already relate to human body and human mind. I mean, like, your mind is very limitless. You can go, you know, is the moment you can go to the US, and then you can come back to Bangkok, and then you go back to the UK, and so on, right? That's how flexible your mind is. It's the same thing with computers. So literally the field of computer science opened up some of my eyes, and you know, like literally, okay, so this is it, right? If I knew, I would have picked this subject, right? So that's the thing, right? In life, it sometimes picks something that could be better for you than you think it is was better for you before, right? So I went on with it. I 2 years, 3 years down the line. But the challenge I had was it was very practical, you know, like logic, you know, theoretical. And I'm always a practical guy. Mm-hmm. So if they taught me how the how the computer thinks, how you program it, and so on. Like without really me programming things, I wouldn't really know how it was like, right? So you know, I struggle. Don't worry about it. I mean, like the third year, the fourth year, I struggled. Some subjects that I did well was the one with the practical view.
Right? Not practical totally. Involved,
right? Yeah. So you know, I did my senior assignment. Towards the end, my grades were bad, to be honest. But I did that assignment, I'm very proud of it even today. Like, you know, yeah. One of the best that I could ever get. Like the GPA 4 person was actually asking me, Andy, how do you, can you help me how to code this? So that you see that I perform in some areas that, you know, outperform in some areas that, you know, like the best people in the faculty has to even come to me and ask for my input and stuff. Like, you know, of course, right? Like if you try to balance things out, then I'm way like lower in terms of GPA than that person, right? Because then you are rated based on your GPA.
Yeah.
This is, again, life.
But the doing was your forte. And I know that you went into this thinking potentially the programming sides, because you had one programming side that you were used to, which was the hardware side, and then you were brought into this new area. And when you were talking about coding, you mentioned that you thought you'd be this hacker with the hoodie in a room, and that was the expectation versus reality of where you went
Yeah, exactly. So that the thing about that, I mean, that's my sort of this side of phase where, you know, I've, you know, once I graduated from the university, I was like, look, I did that, you know, senior assignment with flying colors. I got an A, and, you know, like, I was very proud. I was very pumped. And then I'm going to, okay, look, you know, here comes Andy to the world, right? Like, you know, I'm going to work. Started looking for a job. Then the reality is that, you know, graduates, you all know, right? Like, you know, you got to take any job that comes in front of you, right? You don't have a lot of choice. So I was very good at C# programming at that time. So like, it's a Windows application that I did, right? So like, yeah, okay, I'm going to write Windows application. I don't know, just, you know, I can find some jobs. But the job that I got was PHP website programming, right? Was like boring, you know, it's not fancy enough, you know, like, yeah, but anyway, I need a salary anyway, you know, like, you need an income, so, you know, might as well take the opportunity. That's where I got open up doors to the world of online.
Ooh.
Which is to me a much more interesting space. I mean, I don't mean anything negative about people who write operating system applications and so on. But then, you know, there are good things about it. But then, like, you know, for me, I'm more interested in online. But I didn't know, right? You see what I mean? Like, I ran into that again. It's like online. Okay, fine. And I started writing websites and so on. Right now, of course, I was introduced to, I move on to, you know, then I was on the agency side.
Mm-hmm.
I was been hired by this agency, digital agency, to do a PHP programming, a lead developer. I found myself doing the coding and stuff over there again, and you know, I code till the sun goes up, rise in the sky, and then that was, you know, I was very proud of that. Yeah, you know, like, doing that thing, I was competing with others on things that I shouldn't be very proud of. But anyway, I was young and useless anyway, so I tried. You see what I mean? Like, you know, you have plenty of time, you have plenty of energy, you have plenty of emptiness in your head. So you go on, you do a lot of crazy things, and you get very proud of anyway, right? So I landed upon this project to put, you know, a grocery store online. And that was a good, you know, another experience that I got in terms of managing some people. It's not, to me, I have been given a role to manage people, but then I wasn't managing people. I was managing the project. I was managing my goal. I was managing the outcomes.
Yes.
Well, nobody told me what people management was like. Nobody taught me before. So I was doing the things that I thought it was correct. And then, you know, I was literally surrounded by people who would, you know, basically, hopefully, out of randomness, they would have this share the same purpose with me. So, yeah, I did, you know, deliver that project. And then I was approached by this a colleague of mine that I was working for a freelance job that I knew before. And, you know, he was like, Andy, you know, we have an opportunity in this, you know, this company called Allianz.
Mm.
It's an insurance company. You know, you can join me and work together. So I joined because I thought maybe, you know, maybe I can earn a little bit more. Maybe I can show my, you know, skill set. And to the point that you mentioned, I always thought that I was like that programmer with a hoodie in the you know, in the basement. And the furthest I can see myself at that time was, well, you know, the best I could do is I can show off other programmers how well I can code, how fast I can code, how organized I am. And these are typical, you know, values of being a programmer, by the way. But, like, you know, like you could actually, you compete your logic against other folks and how well you know about things as well. But then you're living the trend. You see what I mean? Nowadays, things are different, by the way. But let me not get into that.
Did you expect to get to where you are now? Did you expect that role?
Not at all. Yeah. Not at all. And that was, you know, that's a good question. Ooh. Because as naive as I was, one thing I randomly made it right was I don't close myself to any opportunity that comes along the way. If I did, things would have been entirely different by today, right? So I was like running into any new opportunities. Let's grab it and see how that goes, right? You know, like no hard feelings. Mm. So I went on with insurance company Allianz, not knowing it's actually also very prestigious as well in Europe. I went there. I was actually find myself building this car insurance application. Extended warranty, you know, like the luxury brands like Mercedes-Benz, BMW. These guys, they give you like 5 years of warranty, but then they also give you an extended warranty of 5 more years, 10 years, they would say, right? But at the end of the day, what the consumer doesn't know or do not know is actually behind the scene, they are re-subcontracting Allianz to insure the other five years, the second 5 years of the manufacturing warranty.
So there's a lot of orchestrating
they're in the background. They're making a bet. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So Allianz is making a bet on the 6 to 10 year of the car, whether it will break down or not, right? Mm. But then, that's the whole thing about the business. And I was actually building the application to operate that.
Wow.
Lots of nightmares, you know.
A lot of nightmares.
When I talk about it, it wasn't all about rainbows, butterflies, and walking in the in the park and the rosy road and so on. But it was terrible. It was. I wish I wanted to run, but you know, I was literally thinking so many nights that I could have run back to the agency, you know, because, I had like 10 people team over there. Ooh. And then I was still hoping that everybody would think the same way, share the same purpose with IM. But turns out that I only had a luck back in the agency, but I didn't have a luck in Allianz where I could see already some differences in the motivations and the team. And that was pretty tough.
That's a powerful statement as well, because a lot of times we can do that. We can just presume that people see the way we see,
yes,
that are on the same page, but it's not that, because every person has a different conscience. Every person has a different way of viewing things.
Yes.
And as we go down the way, and I think this is going to come up later as well,
yes,
with your career journey, but now where you are today, there's more dimensions to your way of leading, which I think is so interesting, because you don't hear that honesty that often about someone going in and saying, it was a nightmare. It was a nightmare. I wanted to run because nobody could see the way I was seeing things too.
Yes.
And that brings a whole other level.
That was a goddamn wake up call, right?
Yeah.
Because, you know, when everything was right, you know, it seems to be in good harmony. And then you think that it's because of you're very good, but it's not actually. You're just living on a credit. And then when the reality strikes, oh, sorry, but what I've known before has already, like, is no longer the case. Mm-hmm. You know, what did I do wrong? When did I start even, you know, living upon these credits, you know, like the thoughts that are
gems.
Not true, right? You see what I mean? And I have to go back and reprogram that mind myself.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, that's like in that loop, you know.
You've been reprogramming yourself the entire journey, it seems. So it's actually quite interesting in that sense. I want to ask you, because that entire experience, saying that this was a disaster, what kept you going when you could have run back to the agency?
Very, very good question. I mean, I was very dedicated to what I always do. And I think at the end of the day, when circumstances hit rock bottom, that's where you find yourself. Okay, so what do we do now? What do we do now? It's almost like a sinking ship, you know, like you have the lights on and then you're like, everybody's running around. And it's like, oh God, SOS, SOS. And I was in that mode a couple of times in Allianz, but then, you know, like, okay, so what do we do? It's like, yeah, you have to keep going. And then, you know, you constantly find new meaning out of the failures, out of the brokenness you face. I mean, it sounds a little bit dramatic, but I think that we have to address it. We have to face, we have to be able to talk, openly talk about these things, because they do exist in everyone's life. It just says that, you know, some people choose to talk about it, some people don't.
Yeah, I think there's a thing in the business world as well for a lot of people is actually saying, oh, this is a sinking ship, everyone.
Right.
It's really hard to say, because a lot of the time you don't trust your gut. Yes. And that's the best thing you have.
Yes.
Is trusting your gut and knowing actually it's okay to say this is a sinking ship. This is a disaster. Does anyone else feel it? Because 9 times out of 10, if that's in your gut, everybody else is also feeling it. So
absolutely.
It's there.
Absolutely. No. So I like when you mention everybody, you know, not saying it out loud, but they were actually in the same state of mind with me. And that's where I started to understand the importance of relationship within the realms of leadership. Now, nobody gave me leadership classes. I mean, you know, nobody even gave me a sense of the need to go and attend and study leadership. I mean, it's like, you know, I was literally doing what I like to do, and that is practical.
Yeah.
Right? Like being practical, like we at the job trying to do it. But I didn't know at the time that I was actually doing leadership on the ground, right? Without having theoretical stuff, obviously. So, you know, when you hit rock bottom, when your team was also like really in the disaster mode, like you kind of find a new meaning. Like, okay, so all of us are on a doomed boat anyway, you know. So you might as well, you see what happens on Titanic, right? They start to play, you know, violin and so on. I happened to build relationship playing violins at 2 a.m. in the morning. Your application couldn't be compiled because it was actually, you know, like lots of bugs and so on. It was Java application. So you have to actually compile before you actually put on the production. And, you know, what do people care in from Europe? Because they're like, it's in, you know, there's still like the time difference and, you know,
yeah.
2 a.m. is like still in their evening. So they're like, yeah, have you put it on live? Have you fixed the problem? Yeah, we were playing violin.
We're playing violins. We're hoping for the best. There's people jumping off.
And that was 2 months, 3 months, you know, you were doing that project. Now that I'm going to share it on podcast anyway, because what happened was we were put again. So here's the thing. It was a little bit political.
Yeah.
Our teams were put against another agency.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, at that top, people make bets. You know?
Yeah.
Yeah. Let me prove you that, you know, this team in Thailand can deliver this, this unreasonable timeline, this unreasonable, set of expectations put upon that project. If we are to do so, then we're going to be able to establish a technology hub in Thailand. I'm so naive. I didn't know I was in that.
You're in that space.
In that space.
The early space.
That. Yeah, exactly. In the center of that.
Before it even knew it wasn't.
You know, exactly. I, you know, all I wanted to do was I wanted to show my you know, skills.
Your HUD-OP, right? HUD-OP programming skills. Can I ask, from the worst projects to now, the projects that you're the most proud of?
Yeah.
Can we go to today? Because at a MarkTech Summit,
yeah,
I know you're speaking about something that you're working on now with Electrolux, which is one of your proudest moments, which was getting all of you getting this personalization stack for customers. Can we talk a little bit about that, what that is, what was the trigger point for that? Because these always come with trigger points.
Absolutely. So, you know, like over long decades, after Allianz, you know, I also learned a lot about this leadership, open up doors to what is truly is. And it's, you see, sometimes when you learn things through theoretical stuff, then it actually, you know, you get to leapfrog because, you know, you already are learning from things that already, what other people already learn from. But the downside of that is you don't have practical experience, right? So you can't really relate to reality. I was the opposite. I always start from practical and then try to reach up to, okay, what does the theoretical stuff says? And I like to do that because I hate theory, right? And so that's my way of learning when it comes to leadership and, you know, management of people, right? It's all about the relationship stuff. I think we will come to that at later part of the discussion, hopefully. So a decade in between, and then I moved to Electrolux. And now that I've been leading the consumer engagement solutions, and, you know, we did that, to your question, personalization initiative started off last year. What was the trigger point? You know, we try to ask ourselves, what would it take for us to be continue to be competitive on the market? It's a fair question, right? Because, I mean, nowadays, let alone be that you're trying to improve to be in a better state, maintaining your position is already hard enough, right? And we weren't really greedy about it. We were trying, okay, so what does it mean to maintain our position? And we learned that, okay, look, you know, the organizations who know their consumer very well and what their consumer are looking for, and spend your energy, spend your effort, all of that to those things that your consumer are looking for may give you a chance to hold your position. It will may give you a chance. It's not a guaranteed, but may give you a chance, right? So we started off, okay, so what do we need to do to achieve it, right? So like, okay, so we need to, first of all, do we know our consumers? You know, like, you need to be true to yourself as well, right? Sometimes we live on the old assumptions, you know, best practices, right? Like, hey, you know what? We've been doing that every time.
The way we've always done it.
best practice. So, you know, we rely on best practice. But that's, you know, what takes you here won't take you there. And that's, you know, I like that quote, because it's really is that situation that we're in, you know, like we were heavily reliant on best practices rather.
Was it a lot of gut and guesswork based on old school ways of dealing with data and customer information and just hoping for the best?
No, see, not even the data. I mean, data is to... well, I'm going to go ahead and say it anyway. Data is to, you know, emotional support, you know.
Is it your suit of armor? Like,
I think who you are is defined by what you do. And we in the organization, who we are is defined by what we do. And what we've been doing is always relying on our best practices and then, you know, using data to basically do the emotional support. There's a correlation between what we do and there's a data, right? But that's not the the actual usage of the data, right? So we were okay. So that leads to the point where we say, okay, so do we have enough data? We need to be relevant to our consumers. I mean, we started off investing on the e-commerce D2C and channel, right? Online selling directly to our consumers. But it's pretty much static, right? So we were selling products, but then like we don't really know if we are actually being very targeted and relevant. Like if you are a consumer, let's say, coming to the website and then looking for a refrigerator, and we might be ended up showing you a washing machine, so that's a sort of like we know that. So that's where the appetite around personalization kicks in, right? Like okay, so you know, do we have enough capabilities to do personalization on top of what we have? I mean, like, we're not doing just for the sake of doing it, right? On top of the e-commerce that we have, on top of the data that we have. So we started, you know, architecting the, you know, how the technology should look like, the whole full stack, and the way we organize, within our Electrolux has a lot to do with marketing teams, tech teams, sales teams, and so on, but really orchestrated by the marketing team at that time. So, you know, I happened to get involved as well in that space, right? Because I was leading the MarTech in the region, all globally started off at that time. So, we had the CDP, customer data platform built on top of the data lake stack, but I could go on these, you know, like fancy jargons, but you know, the difficult.
Mainly, we're just not trying to give people fridges when they ask for washing machines.
Exactly. So you know, I'm the bit of a the same situation in reality, which is not always fancy, right? Mm. By the time we went into, you know, like look into the data. Sufficiently, do we have sufficient data to do what we want to do and so on? No, we didn't. We have lots of holes in our data. The data is incomplete. You know, Electrolux have always been decentralized, right?
Yeah.
And you know, we were trying to center in that transformation to centralize more, simplify more. But because you come from that history, decentralized history, you're everywhere you look into in your current state of work is decentralized, including your data. So your data, our data turns out to be that they're made for a very specific purpose, not for other things. So that, you know, if you're lucky enough, maybe, yeah, you might be able to use it, but if you're unlucky, and most of the case you're unlucky, data is insufficient, you can't use it, so you have to go all the way from the beginning to capture the data in the right way, in the way that you would want to use it in your personalization journey, right? So we ran into that many, many topics, many, many challenges. But then, of course, we also learned that, you know, we also get to see who we really are. And I think that is very valuable. You know, just like if you're on a diet and, you know, you want to, you know, really take care of your health and so on. And I, you know, one thing that works for me, and I tried many ways, but like one thing that really worked for me is all you do is start tracking your diet for a week. Just track what you eat. You know, you don't need to change it. Just track and see what it tells you. And we were in that state, you know, we were started tracking what we, you know, the data we have, what we do, and there are some useful information and so on. And we see a lot ourselves, really internal, you know, like inward view, right? And we started to, you know, it's also helped us to change the narrative within the organization, like instead of repeatedly speaking about the best practices.
Yeah.
We then talk a little bit more. Data is a new thing anyway. So we started to talk about data a bit more included in our conversations. And you know, that's the shift in the tone a narrative within the organization. I think these are the things that most fancy tech articles don't talk about, which I think they should talk about more, because that's the start of the change. And, you know, like, I think these, okay, I'm not criticizing them, but then like these...
Go on, say it.
You can. That's a beginner problem, right? Every time you see what an Olympic champion is doing, and you're like, okay, you're pumped, you're gonna hit the gym and see what happens, and then you know everybody see what you do, and you know
you're
like,
seeing the success fine. First without the
exactly.
actual
exactly, but things, the success yeah. that is not within your reachable distance.
Mm.
What I think is more useful for people is, okay, there is a success, but then, you know, what are the baby steps, right? So you see, like, you have to walk before you run. People don't want to talk about walking. People want to talk about running only, where you're actually crawling at the moment, right? So, I mean, see, so I...
We were talking about this before. It was the whole, it's a marathon, not a sprint, in terms of the projects like this, what you're running with Electrolux and how early it is in the roadmap. There's still so much to learn, but even just noticing that problem at the beginning with those great intentions to know your customers a lot better, to be able to serve them in the future is something that a lot of people always get to at a late point.
Late point, yes.
Yeah, where you're already there. So what are you seeing now? How is that?
Yes.
How is this project affecting the business now? What are the great points and the learnings that you're getting to?
No, that's a very good question, because it's almost like my personal journey. You know, we were there with the hope of learning our consumers. We were like, okay, we got the strategy right. You know, like, you wait there, we got it right. Turns out that it's not about learning. Before you learn about consumer, you got to learn about yourself. What can you do, and how can you be part of this game? You know, and we obviously we ran into that. That was just right in front of us. We are in the process of learning more and more about ourselves. What are we still doing wrong that we need to fix, so that we are ready to run, right? You know, because, you know, we can only dream about running, but, you know, we don't even walk straight, you know. Of course, we are in the process of, you know, hopefully by towards the end of 2024, optimization, you know, like improving the way we interact with our consumers. That's the next step, right? Oh. We're not there yet. We're not in the optimization step yet. We're here to still, you know, like, let's say, discovering ourselves, how currently consumers are operating and interacting with us, right? It's not that easy, because, you know, you're talking about we're talking about enterprise level complexity. We're dealing with
global complexity as well.
Yes, yeah, exactly. We're dealing with multiple markets, dealing with multiple regions.
Yeah,
you have different cultures, you have different teams, different backgrounds.
And also, I am going to presume there's a whole lot of work within the culture of that as well, and creating a synergy between technology, people, marketing, everything in that sense too. So would you mind talking to us a little bit about that and how important that has been, and what you've been learning in that space? Because we spoke about this before around the marketing function and bringing in new technology stacks.
Mm.
What have you learned?
Yeah, no... If we want to talk about marketing, I think that we should first talk about, you know, I think the question is more about how marketing is working with other functions. And that has a precedence over anything else. I mean, you know, I have the privilege to be sitting in the middle of the marketing team in Electrolux. So I, you know, literally I can speak on my experience behalf. I mean, marketers are seeing, I think that's it's a bit of a love or hate scenario. You know, this is a love and hate story, you know, marketing versus others.
Yeah.
In an organization, marketing is seen as like, a rich kid on the block. You know, you have lots of money. Yeah, money, you know.
Make it rain,
and
everyone.
And you wear nicely. You seem to be, you seem to be smart. You seem to be do the talking more than do the actual doing.
Yeah. Are you an island in yourself, really, as well?
Yes. And you know, like, and there's always a little truth to the perception.
Yeah.
Like, it's kind of true. I think marketers are, they have to be creative. They're on that side of the game. You know, they're very creative. They have new ideas and so on. But then people with new ideas and creativity not always are good at, execution, right? But, and I'm not saying marketers are not good at execution, but that's a bit of a psychology behind the strength of the teams, right? When you're talking about marketing versus others. So, I mean, I can't speak on other teams' behalf, but I can literally speak on technology teams' behalf. But and that's the challenge that most organizations face. You have a tech team, you have a marketing team split. Tech guys would say, these guys always like tell stories, and you'd never get to come even closer to reality. And marketers were like, these IT guys, like, dude, like, they make me even less smart, like literally, right? Like, I don't want to talk to them. In reality is that, look at an industry. Marketing can't live without tech. You can't. The modern way of doing marketing has to apply tech, full stop. To a point where some marketers started to be like, they're tech folks, and they turned themselves into a very tech savvy being. But they call it a wolf wearing sheep clothes.
The marketeers are the wolves.
Yeah. Well, and nobody knows except if you're a sheep, you know the other guy is the fake one, right? And vice versa. So I was a tech. You see, I always project myself as a hacker in the basement.
Yeah.
And the guy is wearing, trying to be tech savvy. You kind of tell straight out this is actually real or false.
So going forward and this is going to be the thing, right? There's going to be very blurred lines between marketing, technology, and they will have to come together. So how do we integrate that better?
Mm-hmm. I think the talent is very important. First and foremost, you need to start by having the right talents in the team. It's not about having the right technology in the team. Start by, and a lot of times we have that sort of, we tell those lies ourselves, knowing that we kind of know that, but we
this is going to fix everything.
Yeah, this is, let's bring in the new, bring shiny tech and distract everybody. I think we got to be very, very truthful to ourselves within the marketing team as well. Start by the talent. Now, of course, when you have the talent, and I think that another misconception that marketers have, within the team is that we try to bring in the talent, but then like these are all solo players, these are like experts, like the ex-consultant or something and this and that. And they always have this illusion of trying to look smart in front of people is the main driver of, hiring criteria. So, I mean, look, it's important. Don't get me wrong. But it's not just all that, you guys have to be able to work together as well. I think when you put smart people together and they're not aligned, then that's chaos. You don't make any progress, right? And I think what is even more important is we have to attract talents who are able to, who understand not just what they do, what they're good at, who understands how they can actually, who understands other like surrounding like job functions as well. Right, so typically when we talk about marketing in tech, marketers, you have a higher chances of getting successful if your marketing team genuinely knows a bit about tech as well.
Yes. That's and a great vice, place to
vice,
go.
Vice versa.
This tech literacy is a really important part. Yeah.
And tech as well. You cannot have like the best tech guys and drop them in the middle of the marketing team. And as I see what happens, you know, like it's the best way to get, you know, going crazy, you know, chaos.
Yeah.
But then you have tech guys who knows a little bit about marketing, makes the life so different, right? And I think that's, you know, that's so illuminating when I was the marketing technology guy in the organization, because I get to see the both worlds, and I was like, okay, that's, and look, the role marketing technology did not exist before.
Yes.
In the industry.
And it's still in its very early days.
Yes.
Which, you know, it's a space where a lot of people would probably presume you have all the answers. Mm. It's still very early. And there's still so much opportunity there.
Yes.
But it takes learning on action, which is what we've spoken about before. It takes a lot of testing and trialing together.
Yes.
And it's still in its early days of communicating together.
Yes.
And creating that literacy.
Yes.
Within the teams, and not having that expectation that everybody needs to know everything.
Yes. And that is so important, because I think that in some industries, they, you know, you see different level of maturities. If you look at a racing, right, F1. Like, if you look into their F1 team, you have a driver, you have an engineer, but then the driver knows a fair bit of engineering as well. Like, you know, these guys, they know how the mechanics of engine works. Same thing, engineer knows how to drive pretty much and so on, and they are all constantly talking to each other. Have we achieved that in marketing and technology? I would argue so, right? I mean, like, you know, it's like we said, there's a huge difference between what the articles talks about and what really is happening within the organization behind the scene. And I really dare to challenge that in any organizations, right? That, you know,
this is good. The expectation versus reality.
Yeah.
What is really being said out there versus what is happening behind the scenes. And I really want to get into that a bit more, because you mentioned this before. From a consumer perspective, you go into a shop, you buy something, you leave. Perfect. In today's world, there's so much more behind, at the back of that shop, happening. There's so many intricate pieces. There's so much. And not a lot of people know about that, and that's great for the customer not to see. But we as professionals in that space probably need to be more open about all of these things that are happening behind the scenes that are imperfect.
Yes. And it's perfectly normal to have a bit of chaos behind the scene. No problem. I mean, you don't need to have a perfect scenario behind the scene, right? But then, of course, you have to know what's going on. So, I mean, like, I think the best, you know, to your point, right, one of the future trends I really see as a consumer, what they're looking for is, it's nothing re-engineered. It's always been the case. Consumer like to be known by their name and like to be recognized their preferences individually. Right. And of course, you got to have the, you know, product serving, you know, what the purpose of what the consumer is expected. That's obviously fundamental. But like talking about consumer experience. Right. So I think that one of the examples that, you know, industries that are doing very well is, if you look at a luxury type of products, what they really focus on is, like, they really, you know their consumers. It's hard. I mean, it's hard to compare yourselves to the premium and being luxury domain, because they have planned, you know, they have lots of money. They have a lot of investment power to drive that experience. Now, I could argue, though, that if once you become a bit more mature with your operations and tech setup, you could mimic some of those behaviors using technology.
Uh-huh.
So that it's not too costly for you, like you are everything is tailored, even like a, you know, like, yeah, I don't know, like, yeah. I don't want to mention that, but everything is handmade like Rolls-Royce. You don't have to do that. But at least mimic it. You could learn a lot from it. And that's where we should aim for. That should be our main, you know, the North Star of, you know, consumer experience, right?
What key considerations should teams have when they're looking to integrate a new marketing technology or expand on their current stack?
I think your question has the answer, or what I would say the most important answer within, because I think a lot of times we try to look for technology without having in mind how would we scale it in the future. And you know, if you're in a startup business, maybe that's not something you always care about. If you do, then power to you. But, you know, in enterprise, it's essential. In enterprise, this is mandatory because, you know, you literally find yourself, if your technology chosen isn't scalable, you have to start from the beginning again, right? And that's, you know, that's a beginner mistake. Now, before we go too much in detail about scalability, I think that picking a technology, you know, you have a long list of checklists, and, you know, we have like this RFP document, which within IT we worship, right? And that's the thing I always say, you know, like IT thinks the golden record they have is this RFP document, and if they can complete that whole thing checklist and they find the best technology, job is done. No, they forget about Mark, you know, they forget about the organization, what about the project, you know, they don't care about it. It's like, you know, yeah, I have the higher score vendor and they gotta go for it. Perfect, done, job done, you know, like, and that's the scenario where I mentioned earlier about the you know, the F1 team, because, you know, you have IT team who literally has no interest in the marketing job. So they're like, okay, my job is done. You know, go ahead, do your stuff afterwards. And marketing team also tends to know that, unfortunately. So they will always try to avoid that. They will try to pick the solution. And that's the concept of the shadow IT evolves, right? Because they will pick they will try to decide on technology solutions and then later ask for the blessing from IT. Can you sign it? Because, you know, we know what we want. And IT also tends to get a little bit frustrated about, right? It's like, they always do that. Second time is no problem. This is like, what, the fifth time? You know, like, they don't need us, right? They just need our signature, right? anyway, I don't want to get too much into that sort of MarTech frustrations, but I think that picking a technology, what is the other than scalability is important, is expensive technology does not equal success, right? And I know in enterprises there's a typical behavior of why we have even landed on this conclusion. Because I tell you why. If you pick the most expensive technology and still fail, that's not the technology problem, right? That's the notion behind it. So, I mean, I know I'm not filtering here, but that's reality. And I say it without filtering, because I don't want people to acknowledge and, you know, run into the same mistake again and again.
Mm-hmm. The definition of insanity.
Exactly. you cannot get a Ferrari hoping that you will win the race all the time. What if you're in a situation, an off-road situation, where you have to drive in the rain?
Yep.
What's going to happen to that Ferrari that is very expensive, right? Well, you know, like, so maybe you might have a, you know, a random success of hitting the right racing track with Ferrari, but then chances of happening that is almost close to zero, right? So, I mean, that's something to be avoided with expensive technologies. Yeah. But then, of course, the last, like, there's many I can talk about it, because I also share a little bit, you know, a bit of that in my last conference, MarTech conference, you know, back in October last year. And this is an IT thing, right? And we tend to choose a monolithic, like a system that does everything, and like, okay, you know what, like easy, you know, less headache, you know, we have one contract over 10 different contracts, less headache. We have one cost negotiation over 10 different cost negotiation. We have one vendor over 10 different vendors, less headache. So all of that influences the technology decision. It should never be that. So we ended up having a technology that we were sold that this could do everything. But when in reality is that we find ourselves using maybe 30% of that whole technology, the whole thing, mm-hmm. right? You have the whole box, which nobody knows how to use this whole box. So, you know, that's why marketing technology industry, if you look at hard enough, you would see that there are, you know, more fit for purpose, the right size technology working together, modular. So if you find yourselves, if you outgrow, see, that works with your, you know, not going into the most expensive technology from the get-go. You go with what fits your purpose technology.
Yeah.
Now, when you go with that approach, you then soon enough, if you're doing the right things properly over a year, you will soon enough notice that, okay, maybe what a year ago you have chosen is no longer facilitating what you're about to become. So you can, that's totally fine. You pluck it out, you buy another technology that fits that your maturity. But then it helps because you have pieces of technology in your road, in your tech stack that you can do plug and unplug. Whereas if you go with the whole full box of thing that you don't even know what it does, then you don't, you know, you chances are that you have to replace the whole thing. Right? It's not going to work that way. So yeah, I mean, I just wanted to highlight that, you know, like there are consequences that follows, not just, you know, what you see in front of you, but
yes.
Future consequences.
Yes. Yeah. And even that putting your hands up and knowing that that's okay. That's not going to do everything. One thing is not going to rule it all. Try again. Keep trying. Keep testing. Keep learning.
Keep learning. Yeah.
What I want to ask you is the emerging trends now that you're looking at, mm-hmm. and mm-hmm. go straight into that.
Yes. So
look into the future.
There are many future trends. I think the most, the loudest one is the artificial intelligence, yeah. right? I hate to repeat that because a lot of people have already spoken enough and brag enough about it. And, mm-hmm. you know, are they going to replace human beings and stuff like that?
Just are
like
they?
Terminator is coming. No, no one knows for sure because, I mean, if you want to talk about it, if we want to talk about it, we have to go back to this sort of like human civilizations and what is the level 2, level 3, level 4 civilizations, then we will probably realize and maybe one day it will happen.
Well,
you know, we can't just talk about it and be frightened and anxious about it from now, because I think that, you know, I give you an example. When internet was first introduced, I'm sure there's enough people talking about this because internet wasn't that mature enough at that time. So you don't really see that online material about people talking about it, but you see a lot of artificial intelligence talks on the online space today, right?
Mm.
But I'm sure people talk about it, that internet is not good. Internet is
what's it going to do?
You know, change people's, you know, like it's going to take over some people's jobs and make people some people jobless and so on. But it's all about disruption, right? Something comes up, you have to live with it. You have to find a way to work in accordance with it. I think that AI, though, one thing about AI to acknowledge is that AI, the benefit of AI will outweigh the disadvantages of AI.
Mm.
So it's coming. And that's, whether we accept it or not, right? So yeah, that's AI. I'm not here to talk too much about it, and that's my, at least I'm sharing this as my perception of who I perceive myself as a tech guy, I hope you can, it's somewhat useful because I've always been a tech guy.
Yeah.
Then the other trend that is within our reach, within marketing technology, space is the no code and low code trend that is coming. Now, if you look a lot in the history, if you know about the history of programming, you can pretty much predict where this is heading. And I would try to talk from this angle. Okay. Mm-hmm. You know, in the past, when, you know, I started off, you know, back in, I think it was around 2000 something, let's say millennial, post-millennial, there is already a boom, the emergence of object-oriented programming. This is a modern, at that time, a modern type of programming. But like before that time, what, you know, like way earlier, there's other type of programming, but like if you go like back enough in the history, you would see that programmers at that time, years back then, they were doing what we call it assembly language. It's this very, very old school language, very tedious. It's like the least human possible programming language available on this earth, right? Very close to one and zero. Why am I saying this? Because I think no code and low code environment, what we're talking about here is that what we're essentially saying is if we get really to that point, we are no longer going to need programmers doing their coding. Maybe programs are intelligent and mature enough to do their own, organize themselves to do the coding.
Interesting.
Right? So I think this is the evolution of programming as well. So you're coming from assembly to object-oriented programming and object-oriented to further down the whatever you can call it now that we're here towards the no-code or low-code. So like you have like very minimum code. That's the flavor that marketers are always looking for.
Mm-hmm.
Marketers don't want to work with tech guys.
Is that again, looking at that literacy between both, or yes, that understanding between both, and maybe not understanding, not having the ability to share stories between each other, that comes
That's
with
true.
The understanding
that
on both sides.
Maybe that could be very subjective.
Yeah.
Subjective comments from me. So, you know, other people might disagree, but I really think that, you know, conflict is good if it's kept healthy, you know.
Mm.
You know, you challenge people with their thinking, right? So I'm not entirely against it, but then sometimes it's not kept healthy and that's a problem. Mm. So
we could get to a space where there's no code
or low code environment.
Yeah.
So I mean,
what does that do for marketers?
So that will bring another level of maturity to the entire marketing technology, industry.
Okay.
The tech guys, right? They know that marketers have to still rely on them,
mm-hmm.
right? And when you look at in this tech industry behind MarTech. There's a huge industry. And why? Because, you know, as mentioned, you know, marketers have a lot of money, right? A lot of budget to spend. And yeah, so you have a big spending power.
Mm-hmm.
And when you look at this MarTech landscape, a lot of these techs, they are the main, one of the main selling point always is that it's a marketer system.
Mm.
Right, they call it a market system.
Will that flip?
Yeah,
is that going to flip as we go for?
No, so that's a double. That is very dangerous. By the way, you know when you go to the doctor, you know, would you ever ask yourself a question? Do I want to see a doctor who tells me what I like to hear, or who tells me the truth?
Mm.
And I think that with that whole polluted marketing technology industry, they are rather telling marketers what they want to hear. And that is, oh, you know, it's a marketer system, you know, like no IT, forget about it. But then once they sign the contract and then they're like, yeah, so what do we do now? And that's the moment of truth, right? So I really argue that, you know, we are not yet there where marketers can totally step back and get their hands on the technology without the involvement of tech guys. Mm,
yeah.
Right? Mm. But for tech folks as well, it's coming. Guys, find something interesting to do, because this whole thing is coming, and when it happens, then they will no longer need you guys. Right? So
people watching this like, what do I do? Where do I go?
No, but that's the introduction. That's yeah. where the link between no code and low code environment comes.
Yep.
So nowadays, if you're in the conversation between marketing guys and technology guys, and they have to be involved in the same conversation, they have to get involved in the same project, although they may not want it, is because there is an element of coding, there's element of tech piece that both knows is involved.
One of my final questions for today. What do you believe makes a good leader in today's world?
Leadership is a topic that I really value and I really like personally, because it's you know, you could go so deep. And it's partly because it's about human, right? Mm. It's about people and the relationship. Leadership is all about that, you know, or at least start from that. I mean, the leader is, at the end of the day, is just another human being who likes, who appreciates people and relationship, and who knows his own limitation as well. And a leader knows where he's going, who can visualize clearly at least where the destination is, and then has that sort of charisma to bring other people along with him. And because, you know, it's a very tough business, because people have different backgrounds, different motivations, and different purposes, but then, you know, how do you actually put them in the same boat together, right? And I think that's where the toughness comes from. As a leader, they sometimes say you're nothing but a monster, but a control monster. And a control monster is equivalent to a hero, right? So like, and now is a bit of going into that psychology space, but you know, what's the difference between a monster and a hero? Both are destructive. Both have strengths, and both have, you know, let's say, unique ability to change things. Is the only difference is that a hero changes things in a good way, and the, you know, maybe a monster changes in the more destructive way, right? And I think the leader has to have that sort of energy, has that drive, has that vibe. It's very hard for that individual to be that way, because everybody is a human, you know?
Yeah.
And another important thing about leader is that you can be always a nice guy, so that, you know, everybody goes along with you, you know, and that is not a true leader. You know, you can be a Mr. Yes all the time. And the other way around as well, you cannot be that leader that everybody is afraid of all the time. They do the job because they're afraid of you, right? So you lead by, you know, you lead by, let's say, fear, right? The sad thing is that you see a lot of unworthy people in sitting in the leadership role, unworthy of their position, by the way. You know, like, they may be worthy of something else, I don't care, but then we're in the context of leadership. They are worthy of, you know, incompetent, maybe that might be the better word. But then they get to go ahead, you know, they get to get away with it for many years as well. And that is the sad part. But then somebody has to pay for the price for their shortcomings. So none of these two worlds represents a leader. I think a leader is so strong. A leader, when I, you know, I was mentioning about this monster and hero comparison, a leader is a hero here, because he has enough strength to bring chaos if he has to, but he chooses not to. And when he has to, he does that. And that's the leader, right? That's the characteristics that at the core of it you will find. And of course, you know, he brings,
you know, when I say he brings in destruction if he has to, doesn't mean that he's also that scary, because, you know, he has all the qualities, human qualities of people in him that even the most junior person in the organization dares to approach him, right? And that's rare, by the way. That's rare. But I hope that you can relate to that character with someone in your mind.
Yeah, I do. I had a boss that was really good in that sense, that anyone could go to her, that anyone could speak to her, but still she was able to manage or overview everything in a way that quick decisions were made. Everyone was being brought along. Everyone was somehow still at the same purpose and still point of a journey. And there was never anything that you didn't feel safe enough to say, even if it was met with,
yes,
that's not going to work, and here's why.
Yes.
That will work, and here's why. And it's that laser focus.
Yes.
And being able to be human, I think, is the most beautiful part.
I can only speak one topic out of the many, which I hopefully, you know, is one of the most important thing. And that is having the diverse set of thoughts. And, you know, you as a leader, try to constantly look for opportunities to gain and improve that diverse thoughts. Now, a lot of these so-called leaders, and I have been part of that same boat before, I try to find the meaning inside the box all the time. And I don't like to use this word outside the box, because, you know, people abuse it too much. But here, I think maybe most people can resonate better. You know, the way to build diverse thoughts is, it's not where you're not going to find it out of the work you're doing. It's outside, right? So you're like, how much time do you spend outside doing other things meaningfully that you can then bring it back to your work? And then that makes you a whole different leader, right? And so that, you know, that requires a lot of effort. And I'm happy that I know this truth now, but I should have known earlier. Yeah. And basically I do that very, you know, like, this is pretty much, just to explain a little bit, give you an example, very simple, right? Do you do sports? Do you eat healthy? Do you spend time with people and so on? And that is what you do. Like, it really is defined by what you do outside the work. Yeah. So, and I think that a lot of leaders, they forget that part.
There's a whole world outside of.
Yes, they forget that part, and you know, that's not to be forgotten. Yeah. And so you can get the diverse thoughts. You can fix a problem that somebody will take 6 months to think about, and not even coming up to conclusion, right? So that's
That's beautiful. Learning outside of yourself.
Yes.
That has come up before, and it's beautiful to hear it, because I don't think you get to hear that a lot, is going, stepping outside, know that there's a world outside of just the small space that you are, and learn from others, get that diversity in thinking, so that you could bring it all to your team and bring the magic with us.
Yes. And by the way, if you are a mathematician, this is the old concept, you know. You cannot solve a problem right in front of you. So what you do is you actually solve different, you know, in the different context, and bring it back to your original problem. So that's the mathematical, you know, sort of solution to this type of problem. But yeah, it's definitely a tricky one. Definitely a tricky one.
To finish this up, I want to ask quickly, if you could give yourself any advice for your future self, what would it be? In one sentence.
You know, usually I get this question. I know it's going to be more than one sentence. Apologies. let me do two.
Okay, yeah. we'll give you two.
Yeah. One. So people tend to ask me, what would you tell to your 10 years younger version if you have a chance to redo that life again? So that's the kind of question I often get. But now it's like the other way around, where you would tell you. So it's more like reminding yourself, your future self, from here.
right? What would you remind? So I thought about it, and maybe I would say it's something that I know, but I need to remind myself that when in difficult times, you know, you never give up. You have enough evidence in your life that you see, you know, you stay put in all these headwinds and challenges, and you find new meaning out of the brokenness, and that's the most important thing in life. And that is the only ticket for you to get to a better place, right? Because you know, sometimes you might feel like, you know, it's so broken, it's so challenging that you almost want it, you might as well die with it, you know. Mm-hmm. It's like, but that's the right feeling to have. That's the moment of change, because you're actually leaving your old thinking and your old being behind, and you got to take the new one. You can't take both together. And I'd like to remind myself in the future when I, because I know that I might face situation even more chaotic, mm-hmm. right? The bigger, you know, the bigger the change is, the bigger the reward is.
Oh, right? That's so beautiful. That's really nice.
Yeah, so I would remind myself to stay put. Right.
That's brilliant. I love that end piece as well. And the fact that you have enough evidence to know that you can still keep pushing through, and that you are the scientist of your own reality. Andy, thank you so much for joining us on the Forward Podcast. It was such a pleasure to have you. Thank you for giving us your time.
Great pleasure. Thank you very much.